Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mimise Abdelati from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Today, I'll be talking to Susan Hannah Allen and Amy Yuen about their book, Bargaining in the UN Security Council, Setting the Global Agenda, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2022. Susan and Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
So I wonder if you could begin the interview by just telling us a little bit about yourselves. Susan, let's begin with you.
Hi, I'm Susan Allen. I am an associate professor, although just got the letter that says I'm going to be a full professor on July 1st at the University of Mississippi. I have wide-ranging academic interests, but a lot of them center around international coercion or making people do what you want them to do.
My name is Amy Yuen, and I am a full professor at Middlebury College in Vermont. And I also have lots of different interests related to international relations, writing about things like third party intervention. Peacekeeping is something that I've been interested in the past, and also some other research methods types of articles. But right now, it's all about the Security Council.
Wonderful. It's great to have you both on the show. So let me ask you about this book, Bargaining in the UN Security Council. How did you come to write it?
We didn't mean to. When we started, we thought we were going to write a book about what the bargaining process looks like to create peacekeeping missions. But we kept running into the fact that we didn't know enough about the broader bargaining process. And we kept looking and we kept looking and we were like, there has to be a book about this somewhere. Somebody's already written this book. But when we realized no one had, it became imperative that we sort of set that groundwork in case we wanted to write the next book, or so that somebody else could write that book about peacekeeping bargaining.
And in that process, I feel like I learned a lot about how codified the UN is and how codified it isn't, which was fascinating. And that's not something that really comes to the fore, especially in the IR literature, when you're looking at what institutions do and how they decide to do what they do. And I think something else that we ran into was that nobody likes to write on the Security Council. They all write about trade institutions, or they write about regional organizations, but there's this hole around the Security Council, and no one really wanted to take that one up.
I think that's what makes this book such a fantastic contribution. So before we really dive into your argument and your evidence, I wanted to start by asking you to give us some background or some contextual information about the UN Security Council and some of its rules.
Sorry, that was sort of this moment of, oh, who's going to go first? So the UN Security Council is part of the sort of framework of institutions that arises out of the post-World War II peace agreements. It's an effort to try to lock everybody into a cooperative structure in hopes of preventing a repeat of a war on continental Europe, since, you know, we'd done that twice in the first half of the 20th century. In some ways, people like to, at this point, you know, you could probably find an international affairs journal or tweet or some messaging right now that's like, oh, the UN is dead, the Security Council can't do anything. And one of the things that's really interesting to us is countries still send their top diplomats to the Security Council. They keep funding their missions. They pay their dues for the most part. There's a lot of resources invested in making this institution continue to function. And even though it's not necessarily always the most efficient and effective institution, it's what's there. And countries of vastly different viewpoints continue to invest in using that institution to air their dirty laundry, to discuss their disagreements, to resolve conflict, to create frameworks for climate accords, lots of different things. And so we were really interested, why do people keep perpetuating this institution that a lot of pundits want to say is dead?
And alongside of that, I think a lot of people feel cynicism about it. as if it's just a tool of powerful nations, right? That it's not an institution where if you don't have a nuclear capability, for example, you're just really not going to have any sway. And for us, looking at the structure of the institution and recognizing, not unlike the way, say, legislatures, domestic legislatures work, or other domestic institutions that make decisions work, there are some surprising power players, depending on where the rules let you have influence in the institution. So if there's all this investment in the UN and the Security Council itself, and there's a structure of rules that actually gives more power to people, to delegations, actually, than we normally think would have that power, there must be some interesting things going on inside of this institution. And so we looked at the rule structure beyond just how many veto players are there. Traditionally, we think about the veto players, the permanent members, the five permanent members, and don't pay that much attention to the elected members who don't have veto power. But some of the process of producing resolutions and all of the discussion turns out to have a real effect on what actually ends up coming out of the Security Council.
Thank you for that. Now, the book advances this sophisticated argument about agenda setting. And obviously, a podcast is not the best forum to, you know, describe formal models, but I was wondering if you could summarize your theoretical argument.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are three big points that we emphasize in the theoretical model. And one is that there is an agenda setting power. So the Security Council is a body that has a monthly rotating presidency. And the month that a delegation that sits on the council is in the presidency, they also set the agenda for that month, which turns out to be rather powerful. Because they decide, you know, aside from the day-to-day stuff. So there's lots of day-to-day stuff that goes on in the Security Council where they have to deal with missions and they have to receive reports and all of that kind of stuff. But there's also opportunity for delegations to bring particular issues, especially thematic issues. So children in conflict scenarios and things like that, to the attention of the council for discussion, debate, and hopefully action. And so that agenda setting power ends up being really important. It can also affect how they discuss. So there's the opportunity to talk behind closed doors, which can be very effective at reaching consensus agreement so that they can present a united face, or having public meetings, which is part of that process. And in public meetings, you get more strategic behavior on what is the messaging we're giving. So the public privacy, the public private diplomacy angle here is a second thing that we pull out of this process. And the last one is that oftentimes the Security Council is a messaging place. So we see what we call grandstanding behavior. And we look at how the council president affects the ability to grandstand inside the council and who gets the opportunity to stand up and point the finger to make the case. So it's not always about reaching resolutions. Sometimes it's about messaging and who gets the message out there. And we're actually seeing that a lot right now inside the council.
Particularly this month with Russia holding the rotating presidency, they've held meetings on topics that other countries would prefer not to discuss or where there's big disagreement. But the opportunity to air some of those issues and get support from domestic constituencies seems to be really important to Russia, and they're using that platform.
So in trying to test this argument, your empirics begin with statistical analysis of agenda setting in the Security Council, and you use the Security Council agenda item data set. Can you describe for us some of your findings there?
Well, first, I want to describe the process, because this is another thing that we thought ought to exist somewhere. But along the way, we found out that the UN is really, really great at creating documents. They're pretty good at storing those documents. They're somewhat lousy at creating consistent formats for that data. So in a lot of ways, the creation of the data set was a heavy lift, because it required a lot of effort of, oh, wait, the reports look different in this year. And so we couldn't just sort of magically web scrape all the data and have it, you know, spit into some beautiful Excel file. A lot of hard hand coding work was done by the two of us and by some students. And so the data are great. I can say definitely that the data are right because I've spent a lot of time cleaning them. But it was really interesting to sort of then take a day by day view of the council and then sort of look at across time. When does the council act? What are they doing? I mean, they pass an average of 56 resolutions a year. They meet an average of 275 times a year. So this is a busy organization, and keeping track of what gets talked about, but also what doesn't get talked about is really important. I mean, obviously there are issues that don't show up on the council's agenda. And so we were curious to see not only what's there, but what's not there. Are there things that are only discussed in private? Are there things that are discussed only in public so that people can argue about them? And so we collected this agenda data and then began to look at whether or not there are factors, systematic factors, that help us predict what items are going to get a hearing, what items are going to get a public hearing, and thus countries are staking reputational costs on those issues. And so we looked at sort of two key aspects of the agenda process. One of those has to do with the rules. And Amy's talked about this a little bit, that the rotating presidency makes a difference, that elected members get at least one and sometimes two chances during their 2 years on the council to guide what's going to be discussed. And that has an impact. We see that elected members pick different issues to put on the council. The other thing that we look at is preference variation among the permanent members. So it's not necessarily just what does the United States want to do? You know, we might have this idea that the Security Council is just what the most powerful state wants to do all the time. What we were really interested in is how closely clustered preferences among the permanent members are, or how spread out they are. So is this an issue where China and the US can get on the same page quickly? Or is this an issue where their preferences are so far apart that it's probably not going to result in a resolution and isn't worth discussing? And we found that on issues where there's a tight clustering of preferences, it's much more likely that the council is going to take action.
Thank you. So after that, you also kind of stick with statistical analysis, and you look at the effect of outside options, right? So the possibility that states might act unilaterally outside of the Security Council. Tell us about that.
Sure. So this was an interesting opportunity to take someone else's formal model. We didn't make Amy create two formal models and solve them for this book. That would have been cruel and unusual punishment for her. but this was an opportunity for us to take an existing formal model written by Eric Vooten, who sort of looked at, does the US's threat of unilateral action increase or decrease bargaining space within the council? Does it make it easier for other countries to get on board with multilateral action if the US can credibly say, well, you guys can either join up with us or you can watch from the sidelines? And so we collected data in an attempt to try to test the implications of those models to see whether or not a credible threat by the US or a credible commitment by the US to take some kind of action brought other members of the council to the table. And we found evidence that, yeah, the US can assert some leverage on the bargaining because of its power position in the international system.
Now, the book then sort of pivots in terms of methods, right? And you present a case study of Security Council discussions on North Korea. Can I ask you to summarize those findings?
Yeah, so the idea behind these case studies was to reflect the fact that action inside the council is very complicated. And North Korea has been a topic of discussion for at least 25 years. They've been trying to deal with its nuclear program from inception across a bunch of different domestic changes in the permanent members, trying to deal with how do we prevent nuclear proliferation, essentially, and where does all that come from? And a lot of that work they've tried to do inside the council, because the council members have actually shared this desire to mitigate nuclear proliferation. So it was an interesting case in a lot of ways, because you have an unusual situation where all five permanent members are kind of going, they're swimming in the same direction, essentially, right? And so why is it taking 25 years for them to sort of try and figure out how to deal with it? And it's still ongoing, right? So it hasn't completely resolved one way or another. And for us, it was a good test of the public-private diplomacy kind of question, because there are some difficult points. And the focus in that chapter is on essentially what China's doing, because if we think about North Korea and where it's located, the United States definitely has strong preferences, but there are regional players, and China being the biggest one, that are really sort of calling the shots in that area. And so we focused a lot on what China's considerations are for different actions inside and outside of the council, and what it was that was keeping them from basically going a whole sort of whole hog into sanctioning North Korea to get them to stop their behavior. And what's behind all of this is this concern about collapse of the North Korean regime, right? So the consequences of the collapse of North Korea would fall mostly to South Korea and China to deal with the fallout. And we had evidence to suggest that they were already planning for this just in case, right? There were reports about like phantom villages they were building to house just in case, and all of these telephone poles that were going up and things like that, and discussions about how they would handle the nuclear program that existed with American officials, right, before relations with China really started to sour. But for us, we were talking a lot about how China had to play a very careful game of appeasing and sort of going along with what their international interest is to prevent nuclear proliferation, while trying not to say things that were going to cause domestic political dislocation inside North Korea that would then collapse the regime and create this essentially a refugee crisis that they were going to have to deal with. And so it's basically a history of how the Chinese tried to push back diplomatically to keep like the American delegation sort of from sanctioning too hard, essentially. And all of the public-private diplomacy behind that in order to keep the regime stable, but also look like they were doing something to mitigate nuclear proliferation.
You also consider case studies of how the Security Council handled Kosovo in the late 1990s, and also Canada's involvement in advancing the notion of the responsibility to protect. What do you find there?
All right. So the responsibility to protect case study is all about agenda setting. And we wanted to show, we started this book saying, can anybody else affect the Security Council beyond the permanent members? And the answer is unequivocally yes. And one thing that we found was the agenda setting power. And so the case study on the responsibility to protect is a great example of this, because the permanent members kind of didn't really care. They were sort of saying, you know, responsibility to protect, you know, is a document, it's a thing, it's a policy recommendation, but we're not going to push this issue. And Canada had a really big role in this, because they originally had a lot of peacekeeping soldiers, and they were looking at the responsibility of other nations to make sure that populations were protected. And they essentially took on a coalition building project where they were pulling other nations in who were going to sit on the council as elected members to keep the ball rolling inside the council on this issue that the permanent members just weren't that interested in. They funded a bunch of things outside to try and build consensus around what is this document, what is this resolution that's going to codify R2P look like, giving a lot of ground to China and Russia, who were very skeptical of this, and essentially having the effect of making the Security Council the forum where these kinds of things get decided, which is good for Russia and China because they have a veto power. So they essentially went in and figured out how to build the coalition that they needed in order to get the resolution passed. And they did in 2005. So R2P is now a codified part of the Security Council, which no one would have predicted in the 1990s, right? And so that was a great example of the agenda setting. The Kosovo case is one where we see also some of the public-private diplomacy dynamic that we argue in the book is so important. We found evidence in memoirs that the Russian delegation basically knew that. So the issue with how to deal with Kosovo and Serbia was that they were going to have to use force. And the Security Council was never going to publicly agree to that. So there were behind the scenes negotiations that we found to suggest that the Russians were basically like, yeah, you're going to have to bomb him. And we're going to just, you know, on the side say that's okay. But inside the council, they use the platform to grandstand, to come in to say, you know, this is where NATO is going on outside. Nobody's agreed to this inside the council. This is why the council needs to be the primary decision-making body. So there were great cases to illustrate the different arguments that we had that allowed us to sort of unpack the real negotiations and the real history that were going on in these deliberations.
And it really sort of dovetails with the larger claim in the book that that there are a lot of studies that focus specifically on votes and on missions, right, that are authorized, but that there's not as much looking at the bargaining processes that precede these. And that's really where the book comes in. So we've done sort of an overview of the theoretical argument and the empirical evidence in the book. So I wanted to ask you, what would you say are the implications of this study?
I think one of the biggest things we came away with was a recognition of something that every PhD student in an international organization's class is told, which is that rules matter. We learned that there's a lot more nuance about rules in terms of what are the strict procedures of the council say, what are the informal rules of the council say, what gets said when the mics are on and the lights are on, and what gets said behind closed doors. But we really found that institutions aren't just this amalgamation of powerful states. It's not just a megaphone that's blasting out what the powerful states want. It's an instrument where states have to work within the rules, and where we particularly see elected members or potentially less powerful members making use of the rules in order to advance ideas that aren't always the most popular with the most powerful states.
I would say also, I would add to that, that we've also learned that they know the rules and that they've learned to use them strategically. So they are actors looking at how can I get what I want, but also get it passed. In the same, it functions very similar to how legislators work when they're trying to make deals on the floor of any governing body. And so in some ways, the international and the domestic politics divide is artificial, right? A lot of how the rule systems work are going to generate the same kind of dynamics. And that's what we found inside the council as well. And one of the last things that I think we were really surprised about in just doing this research was learning about capacity, right? So if your delegation has the capacity to know the rules and have long institutional memory like the permanent members have, they're very good at using the rules to their advantage. The less experience you have inside the council, the harder it's going to be. That learning curve is much harder. And so the less time you've spent on the council, the less likely you are to be able to know the rules and how to manipulate those rules, which is what's sort of launching us into the next kinds of projects that we're interested in pursuing on the council.
That's fascinating. So one of the last things you do in the book is you have a brief commentary on various proposals for reform of the UN Security Council. I wondered if you could maybe get into that a little bit.
Oh, gosh. So there are tons of proposals, right? It's policymakers making these proposals. It's actual members who are in the council making these proposals. It's delegations outside who've never sat on the council who are looking inside and saying, what are these problems? But changing the rules of the council is really hard because of the
way- haven't changed the rules since 1986, and that was just to add Arabic as an official language. That was the last rule change for the council.
I mean, when we're talking about a lot of these proposals want to change the number of veto powers, or they want to change the voting rules, or they want to change whether there's a veto at all. Those kinds of changes are charter level. And they're really, really, really difficult. I'm going to go on record and say, I doubt it. We're going to see it just because of the kind of consensus and passage, the way the rules are written now. The permanent members have no incentive to change that. And there's actually been a lot of research done talking about, so they have actually, they have changed the number of elected members on the council and the voting rule that for when resolutions pass since the inception of the Security Council. But the veto players have always been the same.
And that was before we were born, Amy. It was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. But the research has suggested that if you were to increase the number of veto players, you just increase the likelihood of deadlock, which is then going to make the institution less effective, which actually hurts the UN. And so there are all kinds of follow-on consequences that some of these proposals haven't really thought through, that a lot of other academics, not me necessarily, but other smart people have thought about and said, you know, what would the consequence be if we did this rule change? And what they found is it hurts the effectiveness of the institution potentially.
And I think that's a really important tension for the UN and the Security Council in particular. The proposals that suggest larger numbers of elected members or increasing the number of veto players are looking at enhancing legitimacy. The idea is the institution is getting bigger and bigger. There are more and more members of the UN, but the council is staying the same. And it's frozen in a place that looks like 1948, not 2023. But expanding the council might bring enhanced legitimacy at the cost of effectiveness. And I think that that's something that often doesn't come up, or those knock-on effects, as Amy was saying, are often thought through. Maybe you're more legitimate, but you're just sitting around twiddling your thumbs because you cannot agree on anything. Is that really a gain for the institution?
Great. So at the top of this conversation, you mentioned sort of the relevance of this book to current events. We're recording this podcast at the beginning of April 2023. And right now, Russia holds the presidency of the UN Security Council. So I wondered, you know, in what ways your book can help us understand Russia's behavior in the context, of course, of the war in Ukraine.
I think the first thing that we would have to say is that the proposals that, oh, Russia doesn't have a legitimate seat on the Security Council because that seat was gifted to the Soviet Union, is a proposal that's a non-starter. I know it feels good to say, let's kick Russia off the Security Council, but that wouldn't, again, advance the council's effectiveness to act. It would merely hasten the demise of the institution. So I think the one thing in our understanding and recognition that rules matter, breaking the rules can lead to breaking the institution pretty quickly.
I agree. And I think that as much as we are frustrated oftentimes, not just in this instance, but it's sort of heightened in this instance because the Western press is really sort of looking at this and you know, they're looking at what feels like really bad behavior by the Russian delegation, is something we have to tolerate if we want our institutions to be stable and if we want them to be effective, right? Is that sometimes they're just not going to do what we want them to do because they have to reach agreement. I think part of also what we might take away is that Russia is using the council exactly as we would expect them to, right? They're standing up there making their case publicly. It's not clear that that case is really hitting home for a Western audience, but it's not clear that the Western audience is the one that they care about right now either. So we can't forget that domestic audiences are also watching what is happening in the Security Council, and they may be reacting very differently to what they're seeing there to, say, a domestic audience in the United States.
And some of the issues that Russia is bringing to the Council during its presidency are probably not geared towards discussion with a Western audience, but might resonate with the public in India, or with the leadership of India, or with the leadership of China, countries that are more on the fence about the legitimacy of Russian action on Ukrainian territory. And so this is Russia recognizing, I've got a really big microphone and a really big platform for this month. How do I make my case in a way that can compete with everything that's coming out in the Western media? And so they're saying, yeah, agenda setting's real, and we're going to try to take advantage.
It's very helpful. Now, obviously, we've only skimmed the surface of, you know, all of the content that's in this book, and the book really packs a punch. Is there anything we haven't covered that you think is important for our listeners to know?
I would start out by saying that the Security Council matters. We are often looking at the UN and wondering its relevance in this century. I think that because we don't see it day to day coming up in the media. And when we do, it's a lot of criticism about what doesn't pass or what the dynamics are like right now. We get cynical about it. But this council, it's active. And most of the time they're actually putting things through. It just doesn't get the kind of attention, the successes don't get the attention that the failures get. And so this institution is alive and kicking for now. And my fear is that, the way that we see this institution crumble is violent. And so we don't want that to be the road that we're headed on, essentially.
I think to sort of dovetail with that point that Amy just made, one thing that we learned is that the Security Council plays a really big role for other countries in their foreign policies in ways that we don't think about as Americans. The French president and the British prime minister talk about the Security Council when giving major foreign policy speeches. China obviously thinks that leverage in the council is important and has ramped up voluntary contributions to peacekeeping, has increased its number of peacekeeping troops. Other countries are watching the council and thinking about ways that they can make use of this as a tool of diplomacy. And if we as Americans turn our backs, then we're going to be missing a big opportunity. And so I think seeing the way that the rest of the world sees the council has been a really important part of our learning experience on writing this book.
Thank you so much for that. So Susan and Amy, we've taken up a lot of your time. So I just want to ask you one final question, which is, this book is now done, right? It's out in the world. What is it that you're working on now?
So we want to know more about the elected members. There's this argument out there in the political science literature that elected members to the Security Council get a better deal from the IMF, or they get more foreign aid, as though that's the rationale for running for an elected seat on the council. No one that we met, no one that we've talked to, none of the speeches, none of the countries that have campaigned spending millions of dollars to try to get a seat on the Security Council ever mentioned that. And so we're really interested in trying to dig into what countries think that they get out of being on the council. Why does Canada work so hard after it gets the ball rolling in RTP in 1999 to get back on the council to push that across the line? How do countries work in sequence, what they call passing the baton, to keep issues alive? Why do elected members want these seats? Because obviously they do. And we as Americans are like, oh, well, you don't have any power, so why would you want that? We want to know why. And we've been working on a strategy for a deep dive into that. And how states ramp up their capacity to be on the council, what they try to do, I could talk forever about this. I'll stop.
I would also add in the research process for this book and some of the talks we've given afterwards, we've learned a lot about how they think of themselves and where they think their effectiveness shows. So it may not be in the number of resolutions the way we count, right? It may not be that they're heading up and writing, like they're serving as penholder and, that's sort of where they're having their perfect sort of effects. They see lots of other types of actions or language or influence or coalition building as elements of success. And we don't have any measures of that. We don't have any data on that. We don't have any theory on that because we're missing that whole idea about where it is that elected members really feel like they influence the institution. We've looked very closely at the big obvious things, but there's so much more that goes on behind the scenes in these negotiations that we want to look closer to see where the elected members are having influences that we normally wouldn't think about.
That sounds like a really great project, and I hope you'll come back to the podcast and tell our listeners about that book when it's completed. So thank you both for being on the show today.
Thank you.
The book is Susan Hannah Allen and Amy Yuen's Bargaining in the UN Security Council, Setting the Global Agenda, published by Oxford University Press in 2022. Thank you for listening.